Today is Thursday, January 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. delivers written supplies to sweeping Russian security demands on the Ukraine crisis.
All told, it sets out a serious diplomatic path forward should Russia choose it. The document we've delivered includes concerns of the United States and our allies and partners about Russia's actions that undermine security.
Anti-corruption group Transparency International says rights abuses are growing and democracy is declining in all regions of the world.
The 2021 report shows that in 86% of countries, there has been little or no improvement over the past decade.
And the UN reports 128 million children are losing out on education because of COVID-19. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The United States delivered written replies on Wednesday to sweeping Russian security demands. It's a key step in a fragile diplomatic process as Russia staged new military drills on land and sea near Ukraine. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the document handed over in person by U.S. Ambassador to Moscow John Sullivan addressed Russian concerns and raised those of the United States and its allies. He told reporters the response sets out a serious diplomatic path forward should Russia choose it and has a principled and pragmatic evaluation of the concerns Moscow has raised. He added that the United States was open to dialogue.
All told, it sets out a serious diplomatic path forward should Russia choose it. The document we've delivered includes concerns of the United States and our allies and partners about Russia's actions that undermine security, a principled and pragmatic evaluation of the concerns that Russia has raised, and our own proposals for areas where we may be able to find common ground. We make clear that there are core principles that we are committed to uphold and defend, including Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity and the right of states to choose their own security arrangements and alliances. We've addressed the possibility of reciprocal transparency measures regarding force posture in Ukraine, as well as measures to increase confidence regarding military exercises and maneuvers in Europe. And we address other areas where we see potential for progress, including arms control related to missiles in Europe, our interest in a follow-on agreement to the New START treaty that covers all nuclear weapons, and ways to increase transparency and stability. We put these ideas forward because they have the potential, if negotiated in good faith, to enhance our security and that of our allies and partners, while also addressing Russia's stated concerns through reciprocal commitments. Our response to Russia reflects what I said in Kyiv, Berlin, and Geneva last week. We're open to dialogue. We prefer diplomacy, and we're prepared to move forward where there is the possibility of communication and cooperation if Russia de-escalates its aggression toward Ukraine, stops the inflammatory rhetoric, and approaches discussions about the future of security in Europe in a spirit of reciprocity. Our responses were fully coordinated with Ukraine and our European allies and partners, with whom we've been consulting continuously for weeks. We sought their input and incorporated it into the final version delivered to Moscow. Additionally, NATO developed and will deliver to Moscow its own paper with ideas and concerns about collective security in Europe, and that paper fully reinforces ours and vice versa. There's no daylight among the United States and our allies and partners on these matters. We shared our response paper with Congress, and I'll be briefing congressional leaders on this later today and consulting with them on our approach. I expect to speak to Foreign Minister Lavrov in the coming days after Moscow has had a chance to read the paper and is ready to discuss next steps.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Russia is warning that it will quickly take retaliatory action if the U.S. and its allies continue their, quote, aggressive policies, unquote, and ignore Moscow's security demands. Associated Press correspondent Charles de la Desma reports.
Speaking to lawmakers, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says he and other top officials will advise President Vladimir Putin on the next steps after receiving replies from the U.S. to the demands. Those answers are expected this week, even though the U.S. and allies have already made clear they'll reject the top Russian demands. Lavrov says if the West continues its aggressive course, Moscow will take the necessary retaliatory measures, adding Russia wouldn't wait for the US reply forever. We won't allow our proposals to be drowned in endless discussions, he says. I'm Charles de la Desma.
San Jose, California has likely become the first city in America to require gun owners to carry liability insurance. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
San Jose City Council voted in the measure proposed by Mayor Sam Liccardo.
Menes?
Yes.
Perales?
Yes.
It requires liability insurance to cover losses or damages that result from negligent or accidental use of a firearm. The ordinance also assesses a small fee for firearm safety education, domestic violence, and mental health services.
If you're trying to address gun harm and gun harm risk, the idea is to deliver those services to those who have access to the gun.
Sam Paredes with Gun Owners of California says it's unconstitutional and they're going to sue.
This law, in essence, assigns blame to lawful gun owners.
This measure and others are part of a gun control package introduced after a workplace shooting in May that left 9 dead at a Santa Clara rail yard. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The current difficulty in filling many service jobs in the U.S. is leaving hotels scrambling to provide room service. But with a bit of ingenuity and a little high-tech help, some American hotels are finding a way. Angelina Bagdasarian has the story narrated by Anna Rice.
This is the Relay Robot. It now works at the Radisson Hotel in Sunnyvale, California, because of staff shortages caused by COVID-19. The robot is a welcome presence.
There's guests that like that, the fact that they can have items delivered and not have that contact with a human being.
Basic room service that would have been handled by staff is now handled by these robots.
When you get a delivery from a robot, you are not bothering a person. And there's a sense in which, you know, when we think, oh, should I call down to the front desk or should I just go get it myself? Sometimes if you had the sense that they're busy or something, you might say, well, I'll wait, or they're too busy, it's going to take too long. When robots come, they come very fast, usually in around 5 or 6 minutes. And they don't ask for a tip. They don't... You don't have to get dressed for them. You're not bothering anybody.
Steve Cousins is CEO and founder of a company called SaviOak that produces these robots. He says the trickiest bit was to teach the robots to use an elevator.
You have to get the elevator company to come out and modify the building in order for it to work, and that takes a lot of money and time. So what we've done recently is added a little... button pusher to our robot where it can push the buttons by itself.
Here's how it works. Special sensors in the robot can pick the right button, avoid any obstacles it may face on the floor, and finally arrive at its destination. Once it's safely parked in front of the room door, the customer gets a message.
When you have a robot on your team, it doesn't go home. So it's always there. It's available 24/7. It's not like you have to have, you know, 3 shifts a day plus weekends. The robots are available whenever you need them. You know, the staff loves it because they're able to focus on the job they're supposed to be doing.
In California, robots are not only doing room service at hotels and delivering food. They also patrol the streets. These police robots work in the Los Angeles parks. Yet robot designers want to reassure customers that the machines will not replace people in the industry. They merely want to make life a little easier for people and safer at a time when safety is a big concern. Frangelina Bagdasarian in Los Angeles, NRI's VOA News.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the Security Council on Wednesday that Afghanistan is, in his words, quote, hanging by a thread, unquote. He said millions are suffering extreme hunger, education and social services are on the brink of collapse, along with a lack of liquidity, limiting the capacity to reach people in need. He again called for countries to issue general licenses covering transactions necessary to all humanitarian activities. Some $9.5 billion in Afghan central bank reserves remain blocked outside the country, and international support given to the previous government has dried up since the Taliban seized power last August. In December, donors to a frozen World Bank-administered Afghan Reconstruction Trust Fund agreed to transfer $280 million to the World Food Program and UN Children Agency, UNICEF, to support nutrition and health in the country. The United Nations earlier this month appealed for $4.4 billion in humanitarian aid for Afghanistan in 2022.
6 months after the takeover by the Taliban, Afghanistan is hanging by a thread. For Afghans, daily life has become a frozen hell. We need to suspend the rules and conditions that constrict not only Afghanistan's economy, but our life-saving operations. At this moment of maximum need, these rules must be seriously reviewed. I repeat my call to issue general licenses covering transactions necessary to all humanitarian activities. We need to give financial institutions and commercial partners legal assurance that they can work with humanitarian operators without fear of breaching sanctions. We need to jumpstart Afghanistan's economy through increased liquidity. We must pull the economy back from the brink. And this means finding ways to free up frozen currency reserves and re-engage Afghanistan's central bank. And it means exploring other ways to rapidly inject liquidity in the economy. The World Bank Reconstruction Trust Fund for Afghanistan transferred $280 million to UNICEF and the World Food Program last month. We need the remaining $1.2 billion to be freed up urgently to help Afghanistan's people survive the winter.
That's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. A United Nations agency reports 128 million children are losing out on education because of COVID-19, up from 75 million in pre-pandemic days. Lisa Schneier reports for VOA from Geneva.
Since it was launched as a UN Global Fund 5 years ago, Education Cannot Wait has provided a quality education for 4.5 million children trapped in more than 30 of the world's worst humanitarian crises. Fund officials say they now will be able to help an additional 2.5 million children and youth, thanks to a generous contribution from the German government of more than $228 million. The money, they say, will allow millions of young people caught up in armed conflict, forced displacement, climate-induced emergencies, and other disasters to get an education. Germany's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Katharina Stasch, says COVID-19 has threatened gains made in all areas, including education. She says many children cannot and do not return to school even when they reopen. She says this is unacceptable, as education is key to tackling all the challenges of our time.
Worldwide, there are 34 million displaced children and youth. Their number will continue to grow as a result of the global climate crisis, and girls are particularly at risk. We have a shared responsibility not to lose this generation. We must not leave anybody behind.
The director of Education Cannot Wait, Yasmin Sharif, says her agency provides children with a full package of curriculum, learning, protection, school feeding, and psychosocial services, everything that is necessary to achieve a good standard of education.
Which is absolutely critical if we are to achieve any of the other sustainable development goals or human rights. Unless the generation of children and youth in countries like Burkina Faso, Chad, Syria, Afghanistan, and Central African Republic, Rohingyas, receive a 12-year education, we will achieve very little elsewhere in the goals that we have set for ourselves.
Sharif acknowledges Education Cannot Wait operates in challenging environments that are in a constant state of flux. She says the program can function despite the many crises and conflicts around the world because of its status as a United Nations fund. As such, she says the agency has systems and security in place that provide protection. The structure, she says, also enables agency staff to have contact with de facto governments and militia groups they otherwise would not enjoy. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Saad Hariri, Lebanon's leading Sunni Muslim politician and three-time prime minister, has announced that he will not run in parliamentary elections in May and that his future movement will boycott the elections altogether. Some analysts say a boycott by Hariri could undermine the plans for a poll in which opposition personalities hope to gain seats in the legislature and change the toxic atmosphere of the country's politics. For VOA, Dale Gablack reports from Amman.
Saad Hariri took up the political mantle after his father Rafiq was assassinated in Beirut in 2005. Rafiq Hariri, a wealthy business tycoon in Saudi Arabia, was one of Lebanon's most powerful and influential politicians since the end of the 1975 to 1990 civil war. But Saudi Arabia increasingly soured on ties with Saad Hariri as he proved incapable of reining in the Iran-backed Shiite Hezbollah militia's influence in Lebanon. In emotional remarks explaining his withdrawal from politics, Saad Hariri said he sees that Lebanon does not have a chance for a positive future with Iran's growing influence there, its internal divisions, rising sectarian sentiments, and the government's dysfunction. The next parliament is set to elect a new president in October. Professor Habib Malik of the Lebanese American University tells VOA that Hariri's political star has been falling for some time, but there isn't a clear successor for him.
He is a spent force. Saad has huge problems. problems with the Saudis. He has other international lawsuits having to do with his company that did work in Turkey, got into legal trouble there. There's a huge vacuum in terms of credible leadership on the Sunni side there. They are kind of puppets or non-entities. They just underscore the frustration in the Sunni community that real, true leadership is missing.
Some observers say an election boycott by Hariri's Future Movement, Lebanon's largest Sunni Muslim party, could leave his fellow compatriots in disarray and possibly call for an election delay. Mohamed Haj Ali, a fellow at the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, told Reuters that Hariri's boycott pulls the rug from under the whole process and would increase speculation that it might not happen. But Dania Kholia Khatib with the Issam Faris Institute at the American University of Beirut disagrees. She tells VOA the decision by him and the Future Movement will not harm elections, but voters will cross party lines and look to others running who align with their views, including the Lebanese Forces, a Christian-based party.
What they are saying, they want Najib Mikati to fill his role, but I'm not sure he can. The Sunni vote will be divided. Some of them will not vote for Sunni. They will vote for whoever they think represent their cause. So I think part of the Sunni vote will go to the Lebanese forces. Now the Lebanese forces are trying to promote themselves as cross-sectarian. So not only Christian, cross-sectarian.
Mir Jaja heads the Lebanese forces and opposes fellow Christian Michel Aoun, Lebanon's president, and his alliance with Hezbollah. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
An analysis by the group Transparency International says the fight against corruption has stagnated amid human rights abuses and democratic declines in all regions of the world. Henry Ridgewell has details from London.
The Corruption Perception Index ranks 180 countries by their perceived levels of public sector corruption, using data from dozens of sources, including the World Bank. The 2021 report shows that in 86% of countries, there has been little or no improvement over the past decade. Across the world, 25 countries made significant progress in fighting corruption and rose up the index. Roberto Kukuchka is from Transparency International.
The only place where we do not see any significant improvement, however, is in the Middle East and North Africa.
Several Western democracies have slipped down the rankings, including the United States, Canada, and Australia. Again, Roberto Kukuchka.
This is a wake-up call for many of the countries at the top of the index that they need to take care of their institutions. They need to pay attention to the issue of corruption because I think it is much harder to build back what you lost than to preserve what you have and improve from there. We have also had the spread of disinformation and of fake news, which weakens, I think, the credibility in one of the most important watchdogs for anti-corruption, which is the media and the press.
EU member states such as Poland and Hungary have also seen sharp declines. Again, Roberto Kukuchka.
We have seen a clampdown on press freedom. We have seen also a clampdown on academic freedom, with some universities having to leave the country.
Somalia, Syria, and South Sudan, countries riven by conflict, remain at the bottom of the index. While in Mali, perceived corruption has increased following successive military coups. The Philippines, under President Rodrigo Duterte, has also seen a big increase in corruption alongside a crackdown on freedom of expression. Similarly, perceived corruption in Venezuela has sharply increased under President Nicolas Maduro. But there are some improvements, most notably in the Baltic states of Estonia and Latvia, and in Armenia. Again, Roberto Kukuchka.
Where the old government was ousted by civil protests a few years ago, and now we have a more reformist government that is really committing to the fight against corruption.
Transparency International identified a clear pattern in the data. As rights and freedoms erode and democracy declines, authoritarianism takes its place, contributing to even higher levels of corruption. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
In other news, Liberal Justice Stephen Breyer, at 83, the oldest member of the U.S. Supreme Court, will retire at the end of the court's current term that runs until the end of June, giving President Joe Biden the opportunity to appoint a successor who could serve for decades. Breyer authored important rulings upholding abortion rights and health care access, helped advance LGBT rights, and questioned the constitutionality of the death penalty, but often found himself in a dissent on a court that has moved rightward and currently has a 6-3 conservative majority. Breyer was appointed to the Supreme Court by Democratic President Bill Clinton in 1994. Only conservative Justice Clarence Thomas, one of the two black men ever on the High Court, has served longer among the current justices, joining it in 1991. During the 2020 presidential election campaign, Biden pledged to nominate a black woman to fill any Supreme Court vacancy, which would be a historic first. Biden's fellow Democrats hold a razor thin majority in the U.S. Senate, which under the U.S. Constitution gets to confirm Supreme Court nominees. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. U.S. Ambassador to Burkina Faso, Sandra Clark, says if the military installs its own leader, Washington could cut support to the country. This as coup leaders have yet to say if they will install a civilian or military leader after deposing President Roch Kabore, who has since resigned formally. Henry Wilkins reports from Ouagadougou.
In the exclusive interview, Ambassador Sandra Clark said the United States is closely monitoring the situation.
We are carefully evaluating the events on the ground for any possible impact on our assistance. This is a very fluid situation and things are evolving. However, I would note that U.S. law does require a review and possible suspension of assistance in cases where a democratically elected government is deposed by unconstitutional means.
The junta has yet to announce whether it plans to install a military or a civilian president as the new ruler. If a civilian is selected, it may mean a continuation of support from the United States, which has provided counterterrorism training to Burkinabe troops as well as funding. Ambassador Clark says the U.S. would like to see democratic rule restored.
We have called for the immediate release of President Kabore and other government officials and for a return to civilian-led government and constitutional order. And we urge all sides to remain calm and to seek dialogue to address grievances.
Burkina Faso has been locked in a 6-year conflict with armed groups linked to Islamic State, Al-Qaeda and local bandits. The military has suffered a string of significant defeats to the groups in recent months. France also has a special forces unit stationed in the country and provides air and intelligence support to the Burkinabe military. Meanwhile, there's widespread agreement among Burkinabes that the status quo with the country's current military partners needs to change. More than 1,000 people attended a demonstration Tuesday in the capital, Ouagadougou. Speakers called for military support, which has occurred in neighbouring Mali in recent weeks. Alexander Ivanov, the official representative of Russian military trainers in the Central African Republic, issued a statement offering training to the Burkinabe military on Tuesday. Analyst Andrew Leibovich with the European Council on Foreign Relations was asked by VOA why support for Russian intervention is growing.
As anti-French sentiment has grown, as skepticism has grown, and as people have grown increasingly concerned and frustrated with the security situation, that blame has fallen, oftentimes fairly or not, on the traditional partners, on the current partners.
There has been no further word on the whereabouts of former President Kabore, whom the military arrested on Monday. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
Burkina Faso has become the latest West African country to have its government overthrown by the military. President Roch Marc Christian Kabore is the fourth head of state removed from power by a military in the region in the past 2 years after takeovers in Chad, Guinea and Mali, which had two coups in 2 years. Analysts say frustration throughout the region has been fueled by the growing threat of Islamic violence and the displacement of millions of civilians. Anika Hamashlag reports from Dakar, Senegal.
Gunshots rang out near Burkina Faso's presidential residence Sunday evening, according to witnesses, marking the start of the latest in a string of coups throughout the region. The events came a day after anti-government protesters took to the streets to voice their anger over President Hulk-Marc Christian Gabouret's response to a surge of jihadist-linked violence. More than 1.5 million Burkinabe have been displaced by the conflict, up from just 8,000 in January 2018. The Burkinabe are not alone in their frustration over their government's handling of the Islamic insurgency. Issaka Souare is an African peace and security analyst and university lecturer in Guinea.
What the link is that these armed groups in general are attacking people. The soldiers are charged to counter these attacks. And they are saying that they are being sent to the front without being given the proper conditions or the proper equipment.
The event marks the 49th successful coup within 15 ECOWAS member states since 1960, Souare says, and the 8th in Burkina Faso alone. Though most recent coups in the region were sparked by security concerns, they differ from earlier uprisings, which were spurred by discontent over leaders' attempts to cling to power. Fahir Men Rodrigue Kone is a senior researcher with the Institute of Security Studies' Sahel program.
The governance and the democracy question is something still there, but now in the Sahelian country, the trend is clearly linked to the jihadist insurgency, which is really difficult for the elected government to fight against.
These evolving trends are reflected clearly in Burkina's recent history. Gabouret was elected in 2015 following the ousting of President Blaise Compaoré, who stayed in power for nearly three decades. Now, angered by their elected government's inability to fight extremist groups, citizens backing the coup want change. In November, Burkinabe forces suffered the deadliest attack by Islamic militants since the crisis began in 2016, losing some 50 soldiers in a single day. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
Cyclone Ana has killed at least 34 people in Madagascar, two in Mozambique and four in Malawi, where thousands were left homeless. Malawi, which also lost power for 2 days, has deployed search and rescue teams to help people feared trapped in flood-hit areas. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Emile Matei was sleeping at her home in the Jigawa district of southern Malawi, where the floodwaters from Cyclone Ana arrived. A single mother of one child, Matei recounts her narrow escape. She says it was around 11 p.m. I was awakened by the flooding waters from the nearby river, which surrounded my house. That night, I ran with my child to the higher ground, leaving all my property soaked in the water. Matei is among thousands of people in southern Malawi who have been made homeless by heavy rain and floods caused by Ana, which hit Malawi Sunday. The flooding has caused many houses to collapse, forcing occupants to seek refuge in churches and schools. Mateo says in her area, flood victims are sleeping on bare ground, saying someone needs to provide them with tents and other necessities. She says we have nowhere to sleep. Even the churches and the schools here are in the water. What we need most is food and clothes because all our property has been washed away. Chipililo Kamula is a spokesperson for the Department of Disaster and Management Affairs in Malawi. He says the department is still receiving assessment reports from the districts. Kamula could not specify the total number of people affected.
For now, we are still getting some reports from the castles, but the figures, they are on the higher side. Chikwawa alone has over 10,000 households displaced, and Mwanza has over 4,000 people affected.
Four people were confirmed killed as of Wednesday. Kamura says rescue efforts are underway to help others trapped in flood-hit areas.
As of yesterday, we deployed a search and rescue team comprising the Malawi Defense Force, the Malawi Police Service, Marine Department, to ensure that they rescue people feared to be trapped in Mulanje, Zomba, Chikwawa, and in Sanje.
The Department of Meteorological Services says Cyclone Annam has left the country, but warned that heavy rains would continue in some parts of southern Malawi. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinero.